The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Cynthia Schemmer, and I'm honored to introduce our guests this evening. Jacob Schell is the author of tonight's featured book, Giants of the Monsoon Forest, Living and Working with Elephants. In the mid-2010s, Jacob made several trips to India and Burma to meet working elephants and their riders, to study the history and future of their unique alliance and forest travels, and to understand how this symbiotic relationship might even save the Earth's compromised wilderness. He is also the author of 2015's Transportation and Revolt, Pigeons, Mules, Canals, and the Vanishing Geographies of Subversive Mobility. His research is focused on animals, transportation, political geography, and maps, and his writing has appeared in numerous journals. Jacob is a professor of geography and urban studies at Temple University, and he lives in Philadelphia. Nikhil Saval is the co-editor of the literary journal N+1 and a frequent contributor to the New York Times and the New Yorker. In 2015, Nikhil published his debut book, Cubed, The Secret History of the Workplace. A New York Times notable book that investigates the evolution of the office, Cubed was described by NPR as an entertaining look at the history of the modern worker that the modern worker can actually learn from. He is a co-founder of Reclaim Philadelphia, an organization that helped to elect Larry Krasner to district attorney, and was formed out of the Bernie Sanders 2016 presidential campaign. Nikhil is also the Democratic ward leader of Philadelphia's second ward. And now, please give a warm welcome to Jacob Schell and Nikhil Saval.
Thank you, everyone, for coming. Does this sound okay, the mic at this place? It's such a pleasure to be at the Free Library. Thanks to the Free Library for hosting us. Such a pleasure to be here to at the launch of this fantastic book, Giants of the Monsoon Forest, Living and Working with Elephants. It is a beautiful, strange, and I think kind of unclassifiable book about a subject that I personally would have never presumed to be interested in. I ate the lives of Asian elephants in Southeast Asia in particular, but it is just so beguiling, and it opens onto a hidden world that has incredible relevance to our world. How humans have developed longstanding relationships with animals that involve mutual help and aid, how elephants work in transportation and logging, the emotional and love lives of elephants, elephants and how incredibly smart and amazing they are. There's just like, it's just an incredibly detailed look at this, and also their future, the futures of Asian elephants and the people who work with them in a world threatened by deforestation and a warming climate. In the interest of full disclosure, I should just indicate that Jacob and I are very old friends, so it's also a special pleasure for me to be here with him. We work together. We know each other from college. I published in N+1, the journal I edit, an early version of what had became this book. But in college, about longer ago than I want to admit, we both started an urban studies journal together. It was the first urban studies journal at Columbia, which we both attended. Which is interesting in itself. And so I always thought Jacob as being just very interested in cities and deeply interested in city life. So it was very startling over the years to find him going deeper and deeper into hidden forests and spending months and months with elephants completely out of touch with the world. And the result is this fantastic book. So I'm actually just curious what led you to this subject, if we can just start there.
Wow. Well, thanks for that. Question. What led me to the subject? It is true that for years, even going back to basically childhood, I was really interested in cities and making maps of transportation systems in cities. This is like a great, still ongoing obsession of mine. But by the time I was in graduate school, that had really become an interest about transportation systems in cities, but also beyond cities, rail systems, canal systems. This is sort of the kind of thing that my first book is about. And in particular, when I was doing that research, I was interested in how people are moving things around in secret, in a sort of hidden way, on rail systems and canal systems. That's sort of what I was interested in during that period. But that did get me kind of, at that point, marginally interested in the use of animals for transportation, because animals have tended to key in as a really useful way to move things around in secret, either by riding animals or following animals on their trails through the forest or across mountain ranges, or the use of carrier pigeons as a way to smuggle information. And that's just something that was sort of on my radar screen by the end of graduate school. And around that period, I sort of had sort of picked up on the idea that it was this topic about the use of elephants as a way of getting around, as a means of transportation. And that's maybe not 100% the first thing that comes across when people sort of see the book or see the title of the book or the way the cover of the book or the way that it's titled, that there's this sort of transportation-oriented sort of spirit or focus in the book. But that was really where it came from, is this interest in how are people moving things around. But then as I was doing the research in the field in both Burma or Myanmar and also India, in particular the part of India that borders on Burma, it of course became more and more about the elephants and about the people and who work with the elephants and their lives in these very remote parts of the world. And in a way, my interest in cities never really came out of focus. I was always trying to think about how could people, even in an increasingly urbanized period in human history, an increasingly urbanized century, how can we actually share these spaces in the planet with these with animals that are much larger than us? I think that that's always been a question that I have been thinking about while writing this book.
Yeah, and we definitely should talk about how the future of elephants in a kind of more urbanized setting. But so you didn't start as an elephant person, but you clearly have become not an elephant man, but an elephant person. One thing that comes across very clearly in the book is just that is just the detailed observation of this very intimate relationship between the elephant sort of riders and trainers, the mahouts, and the elephants themselves in logging and in transportation. So can you just describe the ritual? I mean, there's some key terms in terms of what the rituals are, what a day is like for mahouts and their elephants in one of these villages. Can you kind of just go into what the kind of daily rituals were of what the elephants did?
Sure. To clarify, mahout is the name. I mean, it's one of these key terms. It's the name of one of these people who works with elephants in these forest locations. Mahout comes out of Hindi. It's also the term used in Thailand generally, though it depends on the group. In Burma, mahout is actually sometimes used, but uzi is the Burmese term. And so that's for me, it's become obviously like a horse rider. It sort of just becomes a pretty common term to use, but that's the term that comes up all the time in the topic. Well, one of the really interesting things about the particular mahouts I was interested in, not necessarily all mahouts will do this, is that they release their elephants into the forest on a nightly basis, which is really significant, both because it's challenging from their point of view. They then have to go every single morning to fetch their elephant, which is tricky. They have to track it. The elephants are sort of dragging a chain, though it's not really tied up by the chain. So the chain leaves a certain trail of evidence, broken twigs and this kind of thing, in the forest that the mahout can follow in order to find the elephant. So it presents this particular challenge, which the mahout has to get really good at. And I was fortunate enough to be able to follow along in this sort of part of the ritual a few times. And it's hugely significant for these work elephants, because if they're in the forest every single night, they can move around more than an elephant in a zoo or a tourist park would be able to do, because they have the whole forest at their disposal. They can find mates, they can mate with each other, they can mate with wild elephants they find there. Asian elephants in zoos tend not to mate at particularly high rates. Some of the biologists that I talked to about the research I was doing pointed out that the elephants employed under these conditions that I was interested in tend to reproduce actually at a rate 2.5 times higher than the elephants kept in even the best of the world's zoos. So that's pretty significant. And this, of course, because elephants are sort of stubborn reproducers. They need things to be sort of just right or they're not going to do it, which maybe is a bit familiar from a human point of view, maybe. And there's other animals like that, giant tortoises, rhinoceroses, but Asian elephants are pretty unusual in the sense that not only do they have this particular quality of being sort of very stubborn about wanting to control their own reproductive patterns, but also they're intelligent in a way that lends itself to doing all sorts of complex labor that that humans are asking the elephants to do, whether it be logging, whether it be transportation during the flood season, which is something I became especially interested in doing while doing this research. So the mahout has to fetch the elephant and then takes the elephant back to some sort of work site. Oftentimes that's some sort of site where logging is happening, usually at a relatively small scale, not at the scale that is that you would find in our sort of logging forests in the United States. And the reason elephants would be preferred for these particular kinds of logging is that it's oftentimes it's teak logging, and the best teak trees, or at least this is sort of the conventional wisdom within the teak logging industry there, especially in Burma, maybe not so much in Northeast India. But the best teak trees are growing at the tops of these hills where they get the most exposure to sunlight. And if they're at the tops of these difficult hills, it's difficult to build logging roads for trucks to actually go up to these locations. And this is something that the British engaging in colonialism in the area noticed would be a problem when they were there in the 19th century. It was something that previous elephant mahouts were aware of as like a unique usefulness of the elephants in the pre-colonial era. And it sort of continues up until the present decade. Elephants are able to play this sort of unique role as being able to access these logs that mechanical alternatives can't access. So that can sort of be very much part of a mahout's day, is sort of fetching one particular prize log. Teak, halong maybe would be another species that would be prize in this kind of situation as well. I could go on like this for a really long time, but I think I'll cut myself off.
Well, you've talked about so the mahouts release the elephants. They have to find them again. There's this kind of nightly ritual. You talk a little bit in the book about the mahouts, and there's feelings about the elephants and vice versa, right? I mean, what is the emotional and other sort of like friendly work quality of the relationship between the mahouts and their elephants? Is it really authoritarian? Is it, you know, how do they relate to each other on a daily basis?
Yeah, that's a great question. The elephants, they are in chains. So there is this sort of, there's this aspect of this particular cultural practice to which I found I had to sort of harden myself a little bit in order to sort of take it in. There's aspects that could be construed as abusive. The best mahouts will tend not to have to engage in any kind of painful activity with their elephants, but sort of less trained mahouts or mahouts who are younger, and so they're less confident in their ability to control this animal, which is much, much larger, like literally 100 times larger, will sometimes use the blunt end of a machete to try to control their elephant. And sometimes I would see these elephants with these parallel scars along their forehead. And so this is like that's like one side of these cultural practices, which sort of I had to sort of make myself take in. On the other hand, there could be really close bonds between mahouts and their elephants. I mean, sometimes it doesn't happen all the time, but you know, a mahout and an elephant, they're both probably going to live around 50, 60, 70 years. And sometimes they actually will literally live their entire lives with these sort of co-aligned life cycles. And then also the teak trees themselves actually also have that same life cycle, more or less. And so there's this kind of interesting co-alignment of life cycles between across these different species. But precisely because a gibbon mahout and his elephant are likely to kind of be together for a long time, and they're both very sort of complex animals, cognitively complex, emotionally complex, in ways that sometimes seem to overlap in very significant ways, or maybe they're kind of adapting to each other. There could be these really close protective bonds. One particular story, I think it's a subject of maybe chapter 6 in the book, something like that, was this ethnically Kamti mahout in northern Burma, who I spoke with in an afternoon at his tiny little logging camp in the Kachin Hills, which is in northern Burma. And he had this elephant, Neong, and all these names are slightly altered, but it's mostly altered because I couldn't spell their names correctly. So he had this elephant, and the elephant actually had a reputation as a killer elephant, in the sense that the elephant had actually killed some other mahout riders who had tried to ride him, and the elephant would only work with Meng Cho, was the name of this particular mahout. And in fact, the elephant had killed Meng Cho's nephew just the year before, which is really startling for me, and also my friend, guide, and interpreter who was with me, a young woman who I named Jay in the book. So there was this particular relationship between this elephant and this mahout, and the mahout would actually spend every single night sleeping in the forest to make sure that Neong, this big sort of dangerous elephant, was sort of staying out of trouble. And Neong, to be clear, despite being a dangerous elephant, was not chained up at night. Like all the elephants doing this work, Neong had totally free run of the open forest in this particular hill range. And sometimes, one hopes was reproducing with female elephants in the forest, but would sometimes kill other elephants. I mean, this is a really difficult elephant, though a very good worker for his mahout, Meng Cho. And so Meng Cho essentially, by sleeping every single night in the forest, was sacrificing his own ability to spend as much time as he would have liked with his own family, his human family, back in the village, which is closer to this large lake in northern Burma called Ndaji Lake. And so that really spoke to this kind of almost paternalistic bond that this particular mahout had with this elephant. And I found that that particular story, I think as much as any other story that I heard while doing this research, got across both the kind of the darker but also kind of more touching and poignant sides of this relationship.
Another thing, I mentioned this earlier, that comes across is just the sheer sort of intelligence of the elephants. One is kind of projecting sort of human measures of intelligence, and at least I am. But nonetheless, I mean, multilingual. They more than Pete Buttigieg, let's say. You know, nothing compared to an elephant. Can you just talk about the kind of capacities of the elephants? Mm-hmm. I mean, you just talk about. I feel like there's a lot of just really kind of startling aspects to how smart the elephants are.
Yeah. And with their capacities in general, I mean, it's both the sort of cognitive capacity, which I think tends to be something humans instantly find kind of just innately interesting, but also the physical capacities can also be really remarkable. I think in some of the sliding photos that we're showing in the minutes before this event, you saw some of the elephants giving rides to these passengers across a roaring river that was in northeastern India. And so these are transportation elephants outside the village of Dambuk who give people rides across this river called the Sisiri. And the elephants, what they're able to do as they cross that particular river, they're not just wading across, they're using their trunk to figure out what's going on with the current, what's going on with potentially unstable boulders at the sea, at the river floor. Swimming in some places, making sure that everything on their back is like sort of correctly balanced in other places. So there's a sort of physical dimension to what they're able to do cognitively. As far as intelligence is concerned, I do think that the most impressive example of elephant intelligence that I encountered was not something that I actually personally witnessed. It's this historical account from during World War II where the British and Japanese had a really intense conflict over the general territory of Burma, and elephants became really prized by both sides, not as like symbolic war booty as one maybe might suspect, or as combat elephants like you would tend to associate with like Hannibal in classical times, but rather for that sort of transportation function that I'd sort of alluded to before with being able to cross this river. So there's this one extraordinary story that one of these British officials that was overseeing a construction of a teak wooden bridge, sort of like maybe the bridge from like the movie The Bridge on the River Kwai, though this would be like a different bridge. And these British construction corps during the war were very reliant upon elephant-based labor in order to get these bridges in the middle of the jungle built, because there weren't already good roads to actually go to those areas, and helicopters weren't widespread enough as technology at this point to actually be used for wartime logistics in this way. So there's this extraordinary account where this one elephant, who with his trunk and his tusks, is carrying a large log to use it on a bridge pylon, and is being asked to climb up onto this pylon with this huge log, and it's such a steep climb up there. The elephant also has like a mahout on his neck, basically, that this log kept, at least according to the account, kept kind of rolling down along the tusks and then over the elephant's head and was about to crush the mahout, to whom the elephant felt some intense protectiveness. So the elephant refused to go up any higher, and all the humans in the situation really had no idea what to do. They don't have literally an alternative to elephants for getting logs up onto these bridge pylons in the middle of the jungle in the year 1942 or 1943, or whichever particular year this was. So nobody knew what to do, and it was actually the elephant, who goes unnamed in the record, but it was the elephant who figured out what to do. So the elephant is then described as wandering back and forth along the riverbank, finding a particular club-shaped branch that I guess was the perfect shape, and then purposing it as a kind of diagonal wedge or a kind of safety lock between the two tusks, and then using the combined power of this diagonal wedge and the tusks and the trunk, which is insanely strong, all those things combined got a sufficiently secure grip on the log that the log was no longer rolling backwards onto the mahout, and the elephant was then able to. So this is something, it's just an extraordinary account because the elephant invented this particular maneuver. And the humans, who probably if you gave them a couple hundred years would have figured that out eventually. but it was like a kind of like a once, it doesn't usually happen in the Burmese jungle that World War II is going on and the two different sides are trying to build these massive bridges on the fly. So, but the elephant was sort of faster in picking up on what needed to be done as compared with the humans, which I think sort of also reflects the physical intelligence too that I was alluding to before.
So the elephants continued to be used, you mentioned their use during wartime. I'm just wondering if you can go into that, you know, you go into how they were used during the Vietnam War and the effects of the possible effects of the American war and on the elephant population, and then the current elephants that you a lot, one section of your book is especially about the current conflict, one of the current conflicts in Burma where elephants are continuing to be used. So I mean, how were elephants used in these kind of later conflicts? And I mean, sorry, how were elephants used in the Second World War in ways that you haven't talked about in Vietnam? And then how are they being used now in contemporary Burma?
Right. Yeah. I mean, this actually does circle partially back to your first question, which is like, how did I sort of get this project started? One of the things that was really fortuitous and helpful to me is the fact that in Philadelphia, there's a large Burmese population as compared with the other cities. It's not like a huge number of people in absolute terms. Many of whom are refugees, some of whom are refugees from the Kachin conflict, which is happening in the country's far north, in Burma's far north. In the Kachin conflict, which by some measurements is the longest running civil war happening in the world right now. It started in the early 1960s and is basically ongoing, though technically there was a ceasefire in the 1990s. on one side of the Kachin conflict between the Kachin sort of separatists seeking some sort of level of autonomy, and the central Burmese government, the Kachin independence militia, independence army, independence organization, they have various names for themselves, they actually employ a kind of a set of brigades of elephants in order to move things around in secret in the forest. So you can sort of see that that was something that was very much interesting to me. And so that's still going on in the present day. And this is in particular around the area of the Kachin Hills and the Hukong Valley in Burma. And the Kachin Independence Army, the KIA, these brigade soldiers, what they do is basically it's the same practice as you see the people who are logging with elephants or doing cross-river ferry rides for passengers with their elephants. It's the same practice where they'll release their elephant into the forest on a nightly basis. Thus, though maybe this isn't exactly the number one priority, thus contributing to those particular elephants' ability to actually reproduce the species. So that was really something that was fascinating to me. And this kind of relationship between the use of elephants for transportation and sort of resistance movements, that's actually a pattern you do tend to see elsewhere. So yeah, in the Vietnam War, we don't see that much discussion of it in our own like American-made Vietnam War movies and this kind of thing. But the Viet Cong along the Ho Chi Minh Trail was employing quite a lot of elephants in order to move things about underneath the forest canopy in secret so that American reconnaissance vehicles overhead wouldn't be able to see what was going on. And in fact, at least at one point in the war, according to some American war veterans, they were flying Apache helicopters and this kind of thing. They were actually under orders to open fire on any elephant that they saw on site, simply because those elephants could potentially be the elephants of the Viet Cong. And then going further back in modern history, both the British and the Japanese were under various kinds of comparable orders to open fire on elephants that, unless they had some reason to believe that they were their own elephants, like the Royal Air Force was under orders to open fire automatically on elephants seen in Japanese-held territory, and that works the other way as well. Interestingly, in all of these particular examples, those sorts of stories sort of trickle down to, well, present-day researchers like myself, because the people who are under these orders have felt upset about it ever since and have wanted to talk about it. And, you know, maybe are also upset about all the humans that they killed, too, but what they really want to talk about is the fact that they were under these orders to kill these elephants, which, at least for some of these war veterans who were subsequently interviewed about this, not by myself. I was using secondary resource for this particular dimension of the research. But they feel that it was somehow unfair to do this to the elephants, to open fire on them automatically because they would be so perceived as being connected to these sorts of mobilities connected to a wartime enemy. So this is something which became very interesting to me while doing the research because of this connection first with the Philadelphia Kachin community and then spending time in Kachin State. And I was lucky enough to be able to interview a particular colonel in the Kachin Army who works with the elephants. And it just became really quite sort of fascinating and unexpected. And you just wouldn't expect that in the year, well, it was 2015 when I did that interview. So in the year 2015, that there would be an army somewhere in the world that's actually making use of elephants. Again, not to employ elephants in combat, which I think tends to be more the way we imagine the relationship between elephants and war in a kind of Western imagination because of the history with Hannibal and these kinds of things, but rather using elephants to avoid areas of combat because the idea is to move things by elephant in secret to the forest away from where the fighting is happening. This is a dimension of the research that became extremely interesting to me while I was doing it.
So these elephants were have been threatened clearly by direct attack and war but by a number of different sort of human interventions over the years. But, what's the thing that threatens Asian elephants today? And you have a sort of surprising, I think, kind of, prognostication or just kind of a proposal for how they might be, their population might be maintained. And you point out that they're not threatened as we might think by poaching. That seems to be not the principal threat to Asian elephants in particular. There's other kinds of threats to their population, but also other kinds of maybe solutions.
Yeah. Right. So I think from a Western and maybe in particular an American perspective, maybe it's a Western perspective overall, I think there is this sort of, first of all, there's this perceptual conflation of Asian with African elephants, which is understandable enough. At least from a conservation standpoint, the two situations are really very, very different. There's about 500,000 African elephants left in the world today, which is a bad number. But it's nowhere near as bad as with Asian elephants, where there's about 40,000 left in the world. So it's like a one order of magnitude in terms of the difference. And a lot of those imagery that you tend to get of like these horrible like poaching events, a lot of that tends to come from Africa and is something that is faced by African elephants. But it has to be said that that's where most of the poaching is happening. And that's where, if you had to compare the two species, that's the species that's doing quite a lot better. So what is it that's actually pushing the Asian elephants to the brink of extinction? Well, it's not really poaching, because there really isn't a massive amount of poaching going on in the Asian kind of elephant sphere. Rather, it's deforestation. It's definitely deforestation. And this is something that, you know, elephant conservationists talk about and emphasize quite a lot. But with poaching, you can sort of imagine, okay, I know what we can do about that. We need more police. Make the police sort of like less corruptible, so that they're, you know, that they're prioritizing the elephants rather than taking bribes from the poachers. And this is sort of the way of thinking about it that you can sort of engage in, and sort of the way the arc of solutions kind of works makes sense. But what do you do about deforestation? I mean, especially from a Western perspective, where for example, in this part of the United States, there's like far less forest than there was several hundred years ago, right? And in Europe, it's basically the same story. So this issue of what to do about deforestation is definitely something that I think in the last two or three chapters of the book focus on quite a lot. So yeah, with these Asian elephants, who again are the trained ones, and it's about 25% of the species who are the sort of trained or domesticated or tamed elephants, they're sort of, in terms of the, I guess, utility that they're contributing to their human communities that are working with them. Some of them are contributing to these, brigades for rebel soldiers and this kind of thing, which is interesting, but doesn't necessarily seem like something we want to sustain. It would be a sort of odd position to adopt for me to say, we need to keep the civil war going forever in order to save the elephants. That's certainly not the direction I would want to go in. And then you have a lot of these elephants, and it's really many more than the ones engaged with the rebel armies, engaged in this activity of logging, which is also interesting, and there's a lot to be learned there. And there's certainly sort of forms of sustainable logging management to be imagined. But it didn't really seem to me, doing this research, like that's really the thing to be expanded, if the whole problem that is facing the Asian elephants is deforestation precisely. It's not like you can increase the intensity of logging in order to provide economic welfare to the elephants, but the elephants need the forest, which you've just deforested. So there begins to be, even though I think that there's certainly a role to be played by sustainable logging, it doesn't seem like that's really the thing to expand. So the thing I became really interested in was the fact that many of these communities are using elephants as a way to get around during monsoon flooding. And the reason they're using elephants is because the monsoon flooding, especially in this part of the world, can be so intense that motorized, tough, wheeled vehicles are just completely incapacitated. This is because the roads will flood, they'll be full of mud, there's landslides, mudslides, debris will wash over from these rivers, which will go from being a little trickle in the winter time dry season to being literally several kilometers in width during the wet season. So those elephants that were photographed crossing the river are crossing such a river like that. Those particular elephants engaged in this kind of monsoon time or flood time transportation service are really doing something that other kinds of human techniques for getting around can't easily replace or reproduce in more kind of synthetic, artificial means. And it's not something that negates the forest. It doesn't require human violence. And so that's something that I really think could potentially be expanded. You can imagine different departments in different governments in South and Southeast Asia instituting something like departments of flood time logistics that would have elephants that would doing actual labor or service for them, which I think could be really helpful both to humans, who I think going forward more and more humans are going to be living on flood-prone terrain, it's hard to predict exactly what the geography of climate change is exactly going to look like, but it seems fair to say that more people are going to be living in areas where the weather and water levels are less predictable. And I think this could be really beneficial to the Asian elephants as well. So that's something that I focus on a lot towards the end of the book.
Just as a sort of last follow-up question before we move to audience questions. So you are saying, I mean, it does, one interesting thing about this is it doesn't suggest that humans need to kind of get out of the way, but actually that this, or that Asian, I mean, there's a point actually, I think you say something like, well, a number of practices among some mahouts here cannot be defended from a conservationist standpoint. Overall, they have a great deal to teach concerned outsiders about how human beings, as morally imperfect creatures, can act as guardians rather than destroyers of the forest last giants. So your suggestion, I mean, if I'm right in understanding this, is that actually this is a mutually kind of sustaining relationship, and it's not that humans should just be removed from the situation.
Right. Yeah. So I think, in a perfect world, what would happen for the welfare of the elephants is that you would look at all the remaining forest land in South and Southeast Asia, and you'd take like a red marker and you'd draw a line around all of it and say no more humans are allowed to do any kind of development of any kind in those particular places, and all the elephants will be there, and they'll be wild elephants, and they won't have to do this kind of labor on behalf of humans. They'll be able to kind of live more or less as they would have lived had there not been humans around in the first place. That would be like a kind of like a perfect solution. I think it's extremely unlikely, and I think that proceeding as if that's eventually going to be the outcome in this part of the world is actually that way of approaching the issue could ultimately wind up costing the Asian elephants their last sort of dwindling window of opportunity to get them back on a better demographic trajectory. So, you know, they're sort of slated to, again, it's hard to predict these things, but they're basically predicted to go extinct around the year 2100. This is Asian elephants. So some people in this room might actually be around then, and maybe we'll see it happen, or we'll see if something else happens instead. And waiting around for these various, like, developing countries in South and Southeast Asia to impose a sort of blanket forest preservation legal apparatus in these areas because we think it's the only possible way to save these species. I think that this is sort of not a great strategy. I think it's probably a doom strategy. I think that all of these countries, understandably, are going to probably follow the same sort of geography of development that happened in the West, in Europe, in the eastern half of the United States in particular, where in order to stimulate economic development, huge rates of deforestation have to happen as well because of expansion of agricultural output, because of increased territories of urban infill and things like that. And so I think that in order to actually do something to reverse the demographic trends with the Asian elephants, it makes a lot more sense to focus on these particular communities which are invested in the continued existence of the forest in both political and economic terms. They're invested in the continued existence of the elephants because they need the elephants in order to derive economic value from the forest. And they have some ability to kind of hold these forces of deforestation, whether it's agricultural expansion or urbanization. These particular human communities have some ability to hold those forces at arm's length. And so I think that's really the area to focus on. If the objective is to protect the forest, protect the elephants, we need to imagine a less pristine and more sort of co-produced, co-species kind of situation for those areas.
Great, thank you. So let's move to questions from the audience. There are microphones in the aisles, so please raise your hand if you have a question for Jacob, and then we'll and please wait if you don't mind until the microphone comes to you. I think we have a question right here.
I'm curious, at the very beginning of your talk, you mentioned the comparison between fertility of the domesticated animals versus zoo animals. But how does that compare? There would be a third category, would be the totally wild elephants. So how do they multiply more or less? You mentioned 2.5 times more fertility in the mahout population of elephants than in the zoo population. But is the domesticated population, are they more or less fertile than fully wild elephants, is what I want to know.
Yeah, that's a great question. I think I would have to go back and read the particular study, which is in the journal Nature, where I got that information from. That was also an interview with one of the authors of that journal too, which because I had questions about it myself. Wild elephants do reproduce at a higher rate than elephants that are engaged in transportation and logging, including elephants that are engaged in transportation and logging and getting released into the forest every night, which is so significant. But exactly by what percentage is the increase? Like, that's what I can't tell you because I don't have that number on the tip of my head, on the tip of my tongue. I think what we're talking about is something like elephants in zoos. It's like 2.5 times from elephants in zoos to elephants engaged in transportation and logging, and then I think it's maybe another. It would be like 3.5 times from elephants in zoos to elephants in the wild. I think it's something more or less in that area, but I wouldn't want to commit myself to that exact number. So again, if the ultimate objective is to just take what we know to be the maximally most reproductive, just the perfect situation for elephants, it really would be having wild elephants and would be having 100% perfectly protected forest quarters, which are big and expansive, and allow the elephants to basically recreate the full range of mobility that they had in prehistoric times, which actually requires them to have many hundreds of miles at their disposal. This particular area, again, we don't have a map, this particular area, it's between India and China. That's basically where this forest country is. It's between the two most populous areas in the whole, in terms of human population, the most populous areas in the whole planet. I don't see drawing that red line around that forest as being a feasible thing to do between now and the year 2100. So even though, yeah, I think that Asian elephants do reproduce at a higher rate, I think that a more kind of complex middle space is really the most fruitful area to look at.
Yeah, you talked about the chains on them. Do they have chains on all four legs?
Yeah, that's a great question too. So what happens is, first of all, during a lot of the day, they don't have any chains on any of their legs because that would inhibit their range of movement while they're doing all this work.
So the chains come off when they're working?
The chains come off while they're working, that's correct. Though they might have some sort of basically a saddle or pannier or basket on their backs, and that has to, of course, be tied in place. But usually that would be done with sort of soft fabric ropes, not with actual metal chains. At nighttime, the typical practice is that there's only one chain between two legs. It's the two forelegs, and it's at a relative. It's sort of slack and allows them to be able to move around as much as they need to do to find things like, again, mates and food. That's the two main things that they'd be moving around for at night. The reason that they have the chain in place between the two forelegs is that they don't want to allow the elephant to run at night, because that can be the difference between the mahout wakes up at like 5 a.m. and has to walk 45 minutes, which is what's sort of typical, 45 minutes maybe to an hour, 15 minutes, something like that, to having to spend the entire day finding the elephant, because elephants, once they're running, they can actually be quite fast. Now, putting it this way makes it seem like the elephants, like all they're thinking about at night is how are they going to escape. And probably what would be more accurate, though that is the case in certain circumstances, but it would probably be more accurate to think about how people who have dogs and live in the countryside will let their dogs out at night. And the dogs don't necessarily have to be tied up. And if they're the kinds of dogs we describe as smarter, then they're probably the kind of dogs that are going to come back in the morning, though not probably have to go be fetched in the same way that an elephant has to be fetched. So it's not a perfect analogy. You focused on one of the pieces of equipment that's actually really important to the relationship, which is that chain sort of fettering the two forelegs of the elephant at nighttime.
So they're out in the forest at night. Can they mate with those chains on?
That's basically the idea. I mean, in particular with the female elephants who are released at night, it's sort of hoped that the female elephants will go out and will come back pregnant, and then will produce calves for the mahout. It makes the mahout just, you know, increases his or her wealth. And there are some cases of female mahouts, not a whole lot. It's a very male-heavy profession. But at any rate, it can increase the wealth of that mahout by like 100%, 150% overnight if an elephant comes back pregnant. So that kind of reproduction is sort of the idea, that that's one of the sort of central pieces of the relationship.
I was just wondering if you've ever witnessed any of the training processes that go on with elephants, on how they're tamed and what they have to go through in order to be a logger?
I have very briefly in terms of directly observing it, because it was very upsetting. So mostly indirectly, which is to say interviewing the various mahouts, or the people who capture wild elephants out of the forest, are called fondies, and what they do is very sort of complex but also upsetting to hear about. Typically speaking, and you know, there's different methods in different areas and that kind of thing, but the kind of image that sort of I think gives you the right idea is an elephant in training will be tied, its four legs would be tied to four surrounding tree stumps or tree posts, sometimes for many months on end, and the mahouts will come back over the course of those months on a daily basis, giving various sort of food treats and things like that to that particular elephant, but basically getting it into the elephant's idea that it's whatever sort of more kind of, I guess, conventional elephant sort of lifestyle it thought it was going to live is not what its future is going to be like. So that can be very upsetting to observe, as you might imagine. There's like a singing, a kind of like a lullaby that sort of gets sung, and though it's not in the book because it's not an easy thing to reproduce the tune, that was something I was able to record because one of the people who does this sang it for me. That was sort of very, very moving, but also, of course, what they're engaged in is very sort of upsetting in a lot of ways. Now, a lot of those more kind of upsetting practices tend to be the kind of thing that mahouts in what I call the more kind of tribal areas tend to engage in. There is this sort of half of, so there's a sort of tribal half of this mahout-elephant relationship, and then there's this more sort of government-controlled half. It's the Burmese government, which is using several thousand elephants to engage in teak logging. And what most of the people I talk to who are connected to the Burmese government's elephant logging areas described is that they've put a lot of effort into trying to institute positive reinforcement-based training that tries to keep the amount of punishment at an absolute minimum and tries to institute as many kind of positive rewards as possible. It tends to be more kind of resource intensive and requires more time and patience, which is something that like a state-run bureaucracy is better able to engage in than these sort of private mahouts in these sort of more tribal areas. So again, like I said, it depends on the particular area, but overall it can be the kind of thing that can be somewhat upsetting to hear about. Though not 100% different than how humans, maybe like in the West, will tend to train their dogs, where there tends to be this mixture of positive and negative reinforcement.
What percentage of the working elephants are female, and what happens when they become pregnant or actually give birth and then they're lactating?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, it's just everything involving like the elephants, I guess the sexuality of the elephants is definitely really interesting. And that was like a type of a type of question that I was constantly sort of forwarding to mahouts. Generally speaking, they would just say it was about half and half male and female. So in terms of just the first question, but in terms of the actual kind of like the labor being done, a big chunk of that would be, especially with the logging where like heavy things have to be lifted and the male elephants are larger than the female elephants on average, that will tend to be more the male elephants doing that. Many of the elephants more focus on transportation work, like giving people rides across rivers. Both of the elephants in the river photo that was on the slide display, both of those are female elephants. Now, when elephants are pregnant, they tend not to be doing the work because that could be damaging, of course, to the fetal elephant. When they're lactating, there tends to be less work, but what begins to happen already by that stage, and this would be like a couple of years into the elephant calf's life, is that the mother elephant is now given some lighter tasks so that, and partially because those tasks themselves, like carrying sort of smaller logs and things like that, might be useful to the surrounding human community, but the real value there is that the elephant calf can observe what the mother elephant is doing. So you have these sort of dual sources of training, one from the humans. By this stage, the elephant would no longer be in this condition of being tied up. And actually, an elephant that's born in captivity, which is the situation we're talking about, wouldn't undergo any of that, like the four legs being tied to the four tree stumps that I described before. That would not be done to an elephant born in captivity. That's actually something I should have clarified when I was describing it, but anyway, I'm clarifying it now. An elephant born in captivity will instead tend to become trained and domesticated both through humans providing quite a lot of positive reinforcement and also through observations of the mother elephant doing various kinds of labor, not so much observing the father elephant. So this is actually true of the African elephant species too. Typically speaking, the situation for elephants in the wild, both Asian and African, is that the calf elephant is raised by a mother and an auntie elephant, and like the adult male elephants are like off doing their own thing, I suppose. And so it seems like, and this is sort of not the kind of thing that, because I'm not a biologist, I can't really, I can't write about this in a whole lot of like systematic detail, but it definitely seems like in some way the mahouts have sort of eased themselves into the kind of mental space, which is usually reserved, in the wild would be reserved for like the auntie elephant. This is sort of my sense of partially what's going on and how this kind of relationship has been possible. And it is a very unusual relationship because the elephants, this is something we didn't get to before, but I should mention it. The Asian elephants are not selectively bred in captivity. They're able to do all these complicated tasks, but they haven't been selectively bred by human beings at any point, which makes them completely different than dogs or horses or cattle or camels and so on and so forth. So they're in this very kind of unique in-between space. I call them domesticated animals, but not domesticated in the sense of being selectively bred.
Elephants are smart, and they're bigger and stronger than humans, so how come humans rule the world and elephants don't?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, for many millions of years, I guess it was the elephants who kind of had the upper hand, upper trunk. Yeah. There are a couple puns like that in this book. It's just a warning to the faint of heart. Yeah, but eventually humans clearly get the upper hand. And there really is a strong degree to which elephants and humans for many hundreds of thousands of years in a row were directly competing over the same sort of geographies, like the same river valleys. Asian elephants today are very much associated with these sort of hilly, forested areas, but if you go back a few hundred thousand years, or even just a few tens of thousands of years, they actually would have been much more focused in terms of where their range is concentrated in these sort of more grassland or plain-like river valleys, which today are these like heavily urbanized corridors in especially India and China. And so the elephants were sort of pushed out of these areas by expanding human agricultural societies into the mountainous hills and had to become these sort of more forest-oriented species as compared to their more sort of prehistoric situation. And there's this interesting process by which they did that simultaneously with certain human cultures who were also fleeing these agricultural societies. So this is something that I talk about quite a lot in this book, is this sort of co-produced history and geography of escape that both the elephants and also certain human cultures are engaged in, and they sort of, at least if you focus on certain cultures like the Kachin or the Kamti or some of these other ethnic groups I was interested in, that kind of dovetails and produces this co-species culture. But as for your question, why did the elephants lose out? I don't exactly know. I mean, the elephants didn't create tools, even though that one particular elephant I described clearly recognized the possibility of a tool. I guess my hunch as far as that is concerned is that the elephants have these trunks, which are really amazing and can do all sorts of things. They're strong, they're sensitive, they're delicate. The sort of flaps at the very end of the trunk can function a little bit like a two-fingered hand. But they don't have 10. So I think the ability to really organize their approach to the world around manipulation of tools and putting things together, I think that there's probably a sort of a limit on that, which hominids have really been able to kind of explore that to a much greater extent than elephants have. So I think that would kind of be my hunch for what the difference is. But again, it's not 100% satisfactory to think of it that way, at least from my point of view, because how come for millions of years actually it was the elephants or the elephantidae kind of family of various various species that really definitely were on top? So, yeah, I'm not sure.
So did you observe any of the communication or the you know, they? I've read about how elephants talk to each other and communicate with each other. Did you observe any of that?
Yeah, it's a good question. The general theme of communication. So I was centrally focused on the relationship between elephants and people who work with elephants, which tends to be these command term systems or vocabularies in multiple languages. And as Nikhil actually mentioned, there is this part where I talk about how a given elephant is able to learn multiple linguistic systems of command terms, sometimes as many as 100 terms in a particular system. And oftentimes the mahouts are able to communicate with the elephants by tapping almost a kind of Morse-like code into on the elephant's ear, which is pretty fascinating. And the elephants are able to do various things with their trunk to kind of return the same tapping. So all these kinds of things. But that has to do with communication between the two different species. As for communication between the elephants, I think that the thing that I observed which comes closest to that is I was in one particular area where a mother and daughter elephant, who most of the time, they do work on opposite sides of the village. So one of them goes into the southern forest area, and one of them goes into the north. But I happened to be around at a particular moment of a particular day when they were crossing paths on a road, and it was the first time in a few months that they'd seen each other. And there was lots of trumpeting and sort of twisting and helixing of trunks. And I don't know, you know, you can imagine what they were. I'm not sure that works exactly as communication. It's certainly kind of like an emotional moment that they had. And I think that would probably be the thing that really stands out for me as a moment like that, like where something between the elephants really resonated as like the central thing going on.
So we have to bring this evening to a close, but Jacob will be signing books outside. I'm sure he'll be happy to answer any questions you have more about elephants, mahouts, and this world that he's unveiled in this fantastic book. So please give him a hand. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.